I'm doing the talk on Mount Zion. This is different to some of the other talks, and all the other ones were experiences of people on mountains. So it'd be good to do a quick recap of the other mountains. Can anyone remember the first mountain that we visited? Just yell out a place, a name, a kind of what happened. It's in the front of your booklets if you can't remember. Also, you wrote notes on them. You can't remember. Mount something, yep. Good start.
Horeb.
What happened to Mount Horeb?
Beth
spoke about it. What did she say about Horeb? James, what did James say about Horeb?
That'd be cold.
Who was called?
Moses
and the burning bush about cooling. Yeah, cool. Next day, what happened? Not to Moses, next day to us.
Mount Moriah Carey.
Okay. What happened at Mount Moriah?
Abraham almost sacrificed Isaac.
Yep. And so he almost sacrificed Isaac. What was kind of, how would you summarize that in a word? What was it about? What did you learn? You learned about, so with Moses, we learned about calling.
Testing,
sacrifice. Any other words?
Idols.
Trust. Sorry?
Trust,
yeah. Cool.
Testing,
yeah. And next day, we're just flipping through these. Carmel, yeah. What happened there?
Prophets of Baal versus Elijah.
Small nuclear explosion. Yeah.
He ran really fast.
What words have you learned? What have you learned in a word? You've learned about running really fast.
Provision.
Yeah, that's a good one.
God's voice.
God's very patient with depression.
Sorry?
Patience with depression. Yeah. No, he takes his time with Elijah.
Yeah. Cool. Next day, where did we go after that?
Mount Sinai.
What happened on Mount Sinai?
Glory.
Glory. Cool. Who was it?
Moses
on Mount Sinai with glory. It's a bit like Pluto, this. We should do it like that. Okay. So, any other things?
There was some golden calf worship.
Golden calf worship? Okay. Any other words? Judgment?
Interceding?
Yeah. Gap.
The shop.
Yeah. Okay, and then yesterday, where did we go? Where were they? Who did it? And what did they do? Pluto.
Mount Transfiguration
and Mount of Olives. And it was
Elijah,
Moses, and Jesus. In particular, Jesus on both of them. James, Peter, and John, sons of thunder. And what did they do? What happened? What did we learn about? You're allowed to say.
I'm allowed to say.
Yeah.
We learned about glory a little bit. We learned about suffering.
Glory, suffering, sacrifice, and victory.
I thought a bit more about it, and it's interesting the contrast that God's glory, man's total liberation, was done by those, like behind the scenes. But Jesus' glory, like when he says that when the Son of Man is glorified, he's suffering. That's what makes up it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's right. That's like on the table.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the mountains that we've done so far. Good to remind ourselves of those. Has anyone like to share anything that they've learned, like the peace of justice? Any other things like that? Don't have to. Up to you. Something cool that you've never seen before. Remember that Anka shared with us. I can't remember what it was now.
It was about the wood. They took the wood.
Yeah, that Abraham took the wood all the way to the mountain with him, so that he wouldn't even let himself have an excuse to get out. Yeah, things like that. Three, two, one. Yep, that's cool. Cool, so in each of these we've actually, I didn't just thought, but we've managed to have it all in a Cluedo type thing. We've got a person, a place, and a weapon, if you will, what happens, what it was about. So the glory, calling, faith, sacrifice. We've got a person in each of them, and we've got the location. Now this talk is on Mount Zion, which doesn't really, there's no story in the Bible of this person went to Mount Zion and this happened. Not in that direct sense, anyway. So it's going to be a bit different, so you have to bear with me. But if we think about the other mountains that we've spoken about, you may have been challenged by some of them, you may have been encouraged, you may have related to some of them, or maybe you've been frustrated by some of them. Maybe you didn't feel like any of them are relevant to you at all, and that they're just a bunch of old stories that happened to people a long, long time ago. And I think they are a bunch of old stories from a long, long time ago. But I believe that there is huge value in stories. I think stories can remind us of good or bad ideas. For example, I was in Latvia 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I met this person who told me a story of how he swam to this island in the middle of this lake. Him and a friend swam out, because it was just a small island. And as they swam, they got there, and they got out of the water, and suddenly all these mosquitoes just bombarded them, just attacked them from every direction. They were being bitten all over the place. And so to escape from these mosquitoes, they ran into the woods on the island. And as they ran out of the mosquitoes, they ran into the woods, and they got brushed up against with all the plants and trees, and it was just itching them, even worse than the mosquitoes. They ran out of the frying pan into the fire, and they were just in agony, so they turned around, ran straight back out, jumped in the water, and swam back to shore. And afterwards, they called that place Itch Paradise. And I've never been there, because I heard that story. I don't think anyone who's heard that story decided to go there. So that's just what a story can do for you. Or how about smaller stories? Maybe ones that our parents tell us. They tell us, remember what happened the last time you stayed up past your bedtime, and the next morning you were really grumpy. Tell us little stories like that. Or remember what happened last time you went swimming straight after dinner. Remember what happened? Or what happened when you ate too much chocolate? It's just stories like that. And I think they can teach us something. But I also believe that stories are more than just moral reminders. So let me tell you a quick story. Many, many years ago, there was a man called Joshua. Now, he had recently been put in charge of this group of people, and the person who was in charge before, he was a really, really good leader. He had done a really, really good job. In fact, he'd led this group through this really harsh terrain. They'd gone through rivers. He had stood toe-to-toe with the world authorities at the time, and he'd not backed down. He had resolved conflict, and he'd stopped rebellions, and he had a special relationship with God as well, one that Joshua had never seen before. And that was Joshua's go to take up the mantle. So he got the group and got them to start to march. And the first thing that happened was they got as far as this river. Now, it was a very big river at the time, and it was at the time of year when it was at its biggest as well, in the flood season. And they also got to it at one of the widest points. Now, Joshua had seen something like this before, and so he steps up. And after a few encouraging words from God and a few directions followed, he safely led all of the Israelites to the other side. The water stopped flowing, and they walked on dry land. And after he had finished crossing, God gave this command to Joshua, which I'll just read. So God said to Joshua, "Choose 12 men from among the people, one from each tribe, and tell them to take up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, from right where the priest stood, and to carry them over with you and put them down at the place where you stay tonight, to serve as a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask you, 'What do these stones mean?' tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. These stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever." So perhaps that has become familiar to you now, wasn't it? So it's the story of Joshua, who was the successor to Moses. And Joshua then led the Israelites into the Promised Land, and that was how they did it. They crossed through the River Jordan. And maybe you know this story, but maybe you know it as just one of those stories, one of the stories that happened to a bunch of people a long time ago. But God tells Joshua that this story is so important that I want you to build something to remind you. And not just to remind you, I want you to tell this story to your children so that they will know who I am and who the Israelites are. I want your children to know who I am, and I want them to know who they are. Now, there was an ancient tradition of storytelling amongst the Israelites. And as they told these stories, they would invite each other to Zakor. Now, Zakor is a Hebrew word, and it means to remember. But it means more than just recalling something from the past. It suggests active engagement, reliving and participating again. When the Israelites listened to the stories of their faith, they put themselves into the story alongside their ancestors. So stories can tell a whole nation where it's come from, where it is, and where it's going. Perhaps the most notable story time like this is the Passover. Every year, the story of the Exodus, the story of how Moses led the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt, was retold to remind the people of their identity. And this still happens amongst Jews today. They still do it. So these stories of mountains that we've heard over the week, they're not just distant stories to us, or good moral lessons to learn. These stories can help us to learn our identity. And yet sometimes it doesn't seem to matter how hard we try, we struggle to find our identity in them, especially as these stories are from a different age and a different culture, and they often seem much more spiritual than anything we might experience. How can these stories tell me my identity when I find it so hard to identify with them? How can I be part of a story that happened so long ago? So I want you to keep this idea of stories in your head and hold these thoughts as I carry on. But firstly, I want you to stand up. So one arm like this. And one arm like this. Then I want you to swap them and do it again and again and keep going. And as you go, try not to hit anyone, I want you to move your shoulders as well and then kind of your chest and then into your hips and get your knees going as well and go up and down. Okay, keep going. And then everyone up and down. And up, and down, and here, and this way, and this way, and again, Again. And shake up. Sit back down again. Right. Are you all feeling more awake? I saw a few kind of bags of theory. If I see people dropping off, we're going to do that again.
No. Okay.
Anyway. Cool. So, here's the question. Has anyone ever asked you, how is your walk with Jesus? How is your walk with Jesus? Have you ever thought what this means? How are your quiet times? What's your prayer life like? How's church? Are you going regularly? What about accountability? Are you keeping with another Christian? Are you sharing life with each other? Maybe just how are you feeling? Are you spiritual enough? Are you drifting? Are you full of joy? Do you feel God's presence often? Do you know your calling and are you following him? The list goes on and on. How is your walk with Jesus? What does this mean? And how about these questions? Where have you walked with Jesus? What have you walked through? Which mountains have you walked on? Where are you walking now? Where are you going? If I asked you to tell me a story of your walk with Jesus, how would that story go? Where would you start? Birth? When you became a Christian? What would the climax be? And how would you end the story? So allow me to give a little spoiler to that last question. How will you end the story? Because for all Christians, it's the same ending, no matter how your story started, no matter how your walk started, no matter which mountains you've walked on, no matter which mountains you are walking on, there is a common end of the story for all Christians. You will walk on Mount Zion. So, get to Zion. Now, Zion is hard to define. It's meant different things to different people at different ages. The word Zion occurs over 150 times in the Bible. And in Hebrew, in the Old Testament, it means sunny place or mountain. And Greek, in the New Testament, it simply is another name for Jerusalem. So these definitions don't really give us any clues as to what it is. But I think that Zion appears to be expressed in three ways in the Bible. The first way is what it was. And this is during the time of David. So David and Goliath, sure we know that story, and King David, City of David, all of that. So when David had captured Jerusalem, and he settled the Ark of the Covenant there. So I'll just read, it's a very quick story of how David captured Jerusalem and what happens. So the king, that's King David, the king and his men marched to Jerusalem to attack the Jebusites who lived there. The Jebusites said to David, "You will not get in here. Even the blind and the lame can ward you off." They thought, "David cannot get in here." Nevertheless, David captured the fortress of Zion, the city of David. And after that, he brings the Ark of the Covenant in there as well. The Ark is, it was the box which the Ten Commandments were placed in, and that was to represent God's presence with the Israelites. That happened in Moses' time, and it was actually when the ark went into the Jordan that Joshua could cross through as well. And so to David, he captures Jerusalem, he calls it the fortress of Zion, the city of David, straight away, and then he brings the ark into there. And the story of the ark being brought in is great, I love it. It's full of joy and celebration. We're told of the way that David danced, and that's one of my favorite stories. I'm sure a few of you will know why. But this is the first way that Zion is expressed. It's the hill on which the presence of God lives. And we can read Psalm 48, which is dedicated to this. If someone would be willing to read Psalm 48, preferably in English, that would be great.
Thank you.
Someone got it? That is fine.
A large is great and certainly worthy of praise in the city of our God, his holy hill. It is lofty and pleasing to look at, a source of joy to behold it. Mount Zion resembles the peaks of King. It is the city of the great King. God is in its fortresses. He reveals himself as its defender. For look, the king is assembled. They advance together. As soon as they see, they are shocked. They are terrified and quickly retreat. Look at them shake uncontrollably, like a woman riding a chariot. With an east wind, you shatter the large ship. We heard about God's mighty deeds. Now we have seen him in the city of the Lord, the invisible warrior in the city of our God. God makes it permanent and secure. We reflect on your loyal love, O God, within your temple. The praise you receive as far away as the end of the earth is worthy of your reputation, O God. You execute justice. Mount Zion rejoices. The times of Judah are happy because of your acts of judgment. Walk around Zion, encircle it, count its towers, consider its defenses. Walk through its fortresses so you can tell the next generation about it. For our God, is our defender forever. He guides us.
Thank you. So this psalm is all about Zion, and it's God's fortress. Just the images that come up there, go and have a look at it. Just look how big this fortress is. Now, if anyone's seen the film 300, then they might know a familiar line. If anyone wants to yell out in a Spartan voice, "This is Sparta," now's the time to do it. Go. Anyway, hopefully we know. I'm not going to do it either. I'm too scared now. So they have this battle cry, "This is Sparta," and that's the best I've got. So that's the battle cry of a proud nation, one that wouldn't be defeated. But if we, if you could reread verses 4 to 7 again.
Luke, the kings assembled, they advance together. As soon as they see, they are shocked. They are terrified, they quickly retreat. Look at them shake uncontrollably, like a woman riding a childbirth. With an east wind, you shatter the large ships.
Okay. Yeah.
Seven?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's Zion. That's like Sparta. It's Zion. Sparta wouldn't stand a chance. So that's the first expression of Zion. It's God's fortress. It's God's dwelling place amongst the Israelites. Now, the second expression of Zion is what Zion is going to become. And we can read this in Isaiah. If someone would like to read Isaiah 17 to 25, just those ones, or if it's a really long passage. Isaiah 65, 17 to 25. You got it again? Yeah. Does someone else want to come do it? No, go for it. Oh. I want Alistair, because I don't know his translation.
For Luke, I am ready to create new heavens and new earth. The former ones will not be remembered. No one will think about them anymore. So be happy and rejoice forevermore over what I am about to create. For Luke, I am ready to create Jerusalem to be a source of joy and a people to be a source of happiness. Jerusalem will bring me joy, and my people will bring me happiness. The sound of weeping and cries of sorrow will never be heard in her again. Never again will one of her infants live just a few days, or an old man die before his time. Indeed, no one will die before the age of 100. Anyone who fails to reach the age of 100 will be considered cursed. They will build houses and live in them. They will plant vineyards and eat their fruit. No longer will they build a house only to have another live in it, or plant a vineyard only to have another eat its fruit. For my people will live long and my children will enjoy to the fullest what they have produced. They will not work in vain or give birth to children that will experience disaster, for the Lord will bless their children and their descendants. Before they even call out, I will respond. While they are still speaking, I will hear. A wolf and a lamb will graze together. A lion like an ox will eat straw, and a snake's food will be dirt. They will no longer endure or destroy on my entire royal making. No longer injure or destroy.
Cool, thanks. So the NIV ends on all my holy mountains, says the Lord. And that's Zion. This is what Zion is going to be, and this is looking forward to that, looking forward to what Zion will be. And you can read through this passage and see the amount of will that there are, the amount of times the word will is used. I counted 23 in the NIV. And there's the amount of times the word will. So, when you read through it, it says, "Behold, I will create a new heavens and new earth. The former things will not be remembered, nor will they come to mind." And so it's very much in the future. This is something that's going to happen. This is something new and exciting, something to look forward to, something to hope for. And there's similar passages to this throughout the Bible as well. In Revelation, the last book of the Bible, we can read chapter 14 and chapter 21. We won't do it now, but there's lots of imagery of this new Zion that will be created. But I'm not going to spend too much time on this. Hopefully you'll forgive me for that. Because I want to get on to the third expression of Zion. And this is the present Zion. If someone would like to read from Hebrews 12, verses 18 to 24. Hebrews in the New Testament near the end. Everyone's there? Cool.
Yes.
Cool, thanks.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. 18 to 24.
You have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm. The trumpet blast was to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged no further words to be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. If even an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned to death. The sight is so terrifying, Moses said, "I am trembling with fear." If you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, to heavenly Jerusalem, you have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church, the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirit of righteousness made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel.
Cool, thanks. So, this passage is possibly ringing a few bells, possibly from Steve's talk, and it's about Mount Sinai, at least the first few verses, verses 18 to 21, and the author of Hebrews is talking about Mount Sinai, and we can read about in Exodus 19. And so Mount Sinai was the first covenant. This was where God said, "You want to encounter me? Good, but you have to be holy." So at Sinai, the law was given, and if you could follow the law, then you'd be holy, and if you couldn't, then you weren't, and at judgment time, then God judges you against the law. And if you haven't kept it, then you're not holy, and you're not permitted to heaven. So this was the old covenant, the covenant of law. The apostle Paul, he calls this covenant the ministry that brought death, that was engraved on letters on stone, a death ministry. But it still came with glory. It was still righteous and holy and glorious. But it was a ministry that brought death. The covenant at Sinai wasn't bad. It was good. The law is good and fair. A lot of people think that the law is bad because if all it does is condemns you to hell, then how can that be good? But I heard a little saying which I really like, which is, if you look in a mirror and you're ugly, it's not the mirror's fault. So that's basically what the old covenant was. quick little side note on the book of Hebrews. The book was written to encourage people to fully turn from Judaism to Christianity, and throughout the book there's comparisons between Moses and Jesus, the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, and eventually in this passage, Sinai and Zion. This passage is written to let the people know what mountains there are and to encourage them which one to choose. And so there are two, Mount Sinai, the Old Covenant of Law, the Death Ministry, or Mount Zion, the New Covenant of Grace, the Spirit's ministry. And Paul compares both of these in 2 Corinthians. If someone could read 2 Corinthians 3, verses 7 to 11, that would be great. Yep, you got it.
Now, if the ministry that brought death, which was engraved in metal from stone, came with glory, so that the Israelites could not live suddenly at the face of Moses because of his glory, transitory though it was, will not the ministry of the Spirit be even more glorious? If the ministry that brought condemnation is glorious, how much more glorious is the ministry that brings righteousness? How far, please?
And 11.
For what was glorious has no glory now in comparison with the surpassing glory. And if what was transitory came with glory, how much greater is the glory of that which lasts?
Cool, thanks. The covenant of the law was glorious, but how much more the covenant of grace? And we approach Mount Zion, no longer condemned by the law, but alive. So we can read this description of Zion in Hebrews 12. If you'd like to flick back there, just have it open. Just three verses, for chapter 12, verses 22 to 24. And the list is much more attractive than that at Sinai. So I'll just try and unpack that a bit. I think often I can read through and they seem like nice things, but I don't really understand them. So I'll try and unpack it, and hopefully that will be helpful. So it starts off with, you've come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. And that's heaven straight away. At Zion it starts with, you have not come to fire, darkness, gloom or storm. No, at Zion you go straight to heaven. It carries on, you've come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. I always find hosts of angels hard to imagine. I tend to just get images from nativity plays of a bunch of kids wearing white dresses. It's maybe cute, but it's not very overwhelming. I think there's a much better image of thousands upon thousands of angels. It's found in a story of Elisha in 2 Kings. I don't know. So Elisha, we've heard of Elijah. Elisha was his successor. I'm kind of carrying on everyone's mountains, sorry. So yeah, Elijah, we've heard about him. He was this man of God, a prophet, and he trained Elisha for a bit. And as Elijah was taken up to heaven, Elisha asked for a double portion of his spirit, and he was given it. So he is now basically Elijah, but the next one. And he's doing all this great stuff. And there's this king, king of Aram, who hears about him, and he doesn't like it. So he decides that he's going to capture him, and then he won't be able to do any more of this stuff and mess his plans up. So I'll just read the story. So basically he's going to send a strong force to capture Elisha, and it's in 2 Kings 6, if you want to make a note. So this is the king of Aram speaking. Go find out where he is, the king ordered, so that I can send men and capture him. The report came back. He is in Dothan. Then he sent horses and chariots and a strong force there. They went by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. Oh, my lord, what shall we do? The servant asked. Don't be afraid, the prophet answered. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And Elisha prayed, O Lord, open his eyes so that he may see. Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Can you imagine that there's this king, a crazy king for some reason, he's decided to capture us all here in Sheldon. And he sent a strong army. They've come along the roads up there, come along the roads down this valley, even around this valley. And there's snipers on the hills. And you get up one morning and you just see them all. But then you look again. And all of the mountains are completely covered in angels and horses and chariots of fire. I think that's a much better image of thousands upon thousands of angels. I think it's pretty spectacular. Better than tinsel halos, anyway. So, what's interesting is these thousands of angels were also at Sinai. They're the same angels. But the Israelites couldn't join them at Sinai. But we can join them at Zion. We read that even if the Israelites touched the mountain, they had to be stoned to death. They couldn't even get close to the angels. But with them at Zion, we can join in joyful assembly with them. So then it carries on. You've come to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. What's the church of the firstborn? Well, we know that the church is the body of Christ, that's us. And what's the firstborn? We know that the firstborn is the one who gets the inheritance. In Romans 8, we read that we are heirs and co-heirs with Christ, and that we share in his inheritance. So when you come to Zion, you come to the inheritance of God. And the list carries on. You've come to God, the judge of all men. God has always been the judge of all men. There's nothing new there. But what is new is that at Zion, you can come to him. Again, if you tried to come to God at Sinai, then he would judge you and bam, you're dead. At Zion, you can come to God and he will judge you on the sacrifice of Jesus. And you live. And you can hang out with God. You cannot be in contact with anything less than perfect. And you can just chill with him. And you can hang out with all the other saved Christians too. And that's the next one, the spirits of the righteous made perfect. So there's fellowship there as well. And the next one is, you've come to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant. Now Jesus is the cause of the new covenant, the covenant of Zion. It's because of him that Zion is approachable and that you get to be with him there. And this is personal and amazing. Maybe not too useful. If it's useful, take it. If it's not, then don't what I'm about to say. But I'll go for it anyway. So think of someone on earth that you really love, a close friend. Now imagine that they've given you a ticket to the best place on earth, Legoland. That's exciting. But if you go by yourself, then it's great and everything. But how much better would it be if your friend said, hey, we can meet you there? How much more awesome would that be, that you can be in an amazing place with the person who's responsible for getting you there, and they're enjoying it just as much as you are? If that's useful, then take it. If it's not, then yeah. Anyway. So lastly on the list, you come to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Now Abel was, you may know him, he was a really old character in the Old Testament. There was Adam and Eve, and they had two sons to start with, Cain and Abel. And Abel worked on flocks, and Cain worked on the floor, crops, ground, fruit, stuff. And they decided one day that they'd both give offerings to God. And so they did. And God looked on Abel's offering, and he said, this is a good offering. I'm pleased with this. And they looked on Cain's offering and said, this is not a good offering. And Cain was upset about this. And he does go to God to start with and say, why are you so upset? And God says, well, you know, this isn't really a good offering. You know that. And if you want to give a good offering, that's fine. You can do that. But Cain, he's just a bit upset. And so he murders his brother, Abel, as you do. And that's the blood of Abel. But I think this is right. I checked this out a bit. But this is those two offerings are the first recorded offerings in the Bible. Check that. But I've tried a bit. But check it again. Those are the first recorded offerings in the Bible. And that's a big moment. like, we read throughout the Bible how much offering and sacrifices there are. Go to Jez's talk on Mount Carmel, there was the offerings to God. Like, it's gone throughout history, and this is the first ever one. This is a huge moment. Mankind has found a way to express love for God in a meaningful, sacrificial way, although, as Cain demonstrates, it can be abused. It's not always good. So if Abel's offering is the first good sacrifice, then that's amazing. But we've come to the sprinkled blood. That's Jesus' sacrifice, and that's so much more superior. That's the sacrifice offered on our behalf, and it's offered to God at his dwelling place, Zion. So this is the Zion that you've come to. Often when I read this Hebrews 12 passage, I think about it in the same way that I think about the Isaiah 65 passage, the will passage. I think about it, something that will come, something for the end of time when I die. But the passage doesn't say that. It says, you have come. You have come. This passage is not about what is to come, but the present reality in what we're already living. You are currently walking on Mount Zion. You can think about some of the mountains we've hiked here in Norway. None of them compare to Zion. And we are currently walking on Zion. You can think about some of the spiritual mountains that maybe you've hiked on. Maybe you've talked about them this week. Maybe you're still hiking on some of them. But none of them compare to Zion. And that is where you are hiking right now. So then we have Zion. It was a physical place in the past that was used to symbolize God's presence with his people, and they could draw near to him there. Then we have Zion, the second one, the new creation, something we eagerly await and will one day live, something we expect and hope for. And lastly, we have Zion, the current reality in which we live. This is not a physical mountain or a place we will one day be, but a current reality. This is the spiritual mountain that we currently walk on. So if we go back to the question, how is your walk with Jesus? Is your answer any different? Where are you walking? Do you know where you are? If you are walking with Jesus, then you have come. You are already walking on Zion. The next time someone asks you how your walk with Jesus is, you can answer, it's pretty sweet, we're walking on Zion together. But what does that look like? If I've been walking on Zion since I became a Christian, then why doesn't it feel like I am? I know I've entered into a relationship with God, and I try to understand grace and accept gifts and blessings from God, but thousands upon thousands of angels? That doesn't sound familiar. That doesn't sound like the place I'm walking at the moment. That doesn't sound like any place I've ever walked. You know, Luke, are you sure this is the current reality? Are you trying to tell me that I'm already in this place of perfect peace and joy? And if you are, then it sure doesn't feel like it. That isn't what I'm experiencing. The answer to that question is yes and no. Zion at the moment is not the same as the new creation. Zion has not yet come in its fullness. That is still to come. And Jesus did a famous sermon on a mount. So I'm going to get another one in there as well. Sermon on the mount. And in this sermon, there's a part of it called the Beatitudes, where he says, blessed are these for this. And just a couple of them, he says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. That is current. It's not the kingdom of heaven will be theirs, but it already is. How can that be if they're poor in spirit? That doesn't sound like my idea. And it's the same with those who are persecuted because of righteousness. They already have the kingdom of heaven. But how can that be? How can the two be compatible? What are we supposed to do with that? Well, I think the author of Hebrews, he gives us a bit more. He doesn't end the passage there. So if we read verses 25 to 29, back to Hebrews 12, if you want to, then if someone would like to read that out, then that would be great. Hebrews 12:25-29. Yeah, Stephen.
See to it that you do not refuse him who speaks. If they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, how much less will we if we turn away from him who warned us in heaven? At that time his voice shook the earth, and now he has promised, once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. The words once more indicate the removing of what can be shaken, that is, created things, so that what cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful, and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire.
Thank you. So this is where the author of Hebrews tells us what we should do about it. This is where he says, you've come to Zion, you're walking on Zion, believe it and live it. We have come to Zion into the presence of perfect holiness, not by our own merit, but by grace. So what are we to do? Well, earlier on in the chapter, in verse 14, it says, make every effort to live in peace with all men and to be holy. Without holiness, no one will see the Lord. We've come to Zion by grace, but that grace is not to be abused. In fact, it's worse to abuse that grace than it is to mess up on the ministry of death. It says in this bit that Stephen just read, if they did not escape from Sinai, how much less will we if we abuse the grace at Zion? That's scary stuff. But the great thing about this grace is that it's not a one-off. We can keep coming back. In fact, earlier in the book of Hebrews, in chapter 4, verse 16, it says, let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. So to abuse Zion is terrifying, but we are able to take hold of that grace. In the last few verses, they talk about the Zion to come, the new creation that cannot be shaken, and how we are to look forward to it whilst living in this Zion. So we have come into God's presence, the heavenly Jerusalem, but we are to remember who God is. God is holy, and if we are to live in his presence, then we also need to be holy. And if we abuse that, then our God is a consuming fire. So back near the start of the talk, I was talking about stories and what stories can do and how stories can be used to give an identity. So how about Mount Zion? Can we gain an identity from sharing stories about Mount Zion? I hope so. Someone would like to stay in Hebrews, turn to chapter 10 and read verses 19 to
25.
Yeah.
Therefore, beloved sisters, since we have confidence to enter the most perfect by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which is first to the curtain of the eyes of the body, and to the great peace of the house of God, that is thrown into God, with a sincere heart and with a sincere spirit that faith brings, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from our guilty conscience and having our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold unswervingly to the hope of the faith, for we need to promise the faithful. And let us consider how we may spur one another on towards love and duty, not giving up, keeping together, as some are in the habit of saying, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching.
Cool, thank you. So we may know that we have come to the most holy place and have full assurance of faith and hold unswervingly to the hope we profess, but we probably still need encouraging. And how should we encourage each other? So a lot of you here currently work for the Navigators, and as part of that you rely on a gift income, and that's quite a scary thing to do. Nothing really seems completely certain. Someone who is supporting you monthly could suddenly stop supporting you, but I want to encourage you to trust in God and know that he will provide. So how should I do that? Can I simply say, don't worry, God will provide? Do you feel encouraged by that? Maybe a bit. Maybe not. But how about if I tell you that last year I was doing that and I was relying on God for my income and I tell you my experience of how God provided for me, even through all of my doubts and worries, would you be more encouraged by my story? I reckon so. As long as it's true, I reckon so. What if I told you someone else's story, who 2 years ago was doing the same thing? And he was really struggling and wondering how God could provide. And he received a brown envelope through his door with £1,000 in it. He has no idea who it was. Still, does that encourage you? I hope so. I hope even more. So we're walking on Zion. And I think we do each have powerful stories about our walk on Zion. Stories that if we share, they can actually help each other, us, with our identities. One of my favorite things about this week each year is that each year we have a bunch of different cultures and people from different countries speaking different languages. And as we get to know each other, we hear a bit of each other's lives and stories. And we have culture evenings, and where someone shares a story of their culture and how they relate with God where they are. And as I hear stories about God in these different cultures, I learn more of who God is, and I'm more amazed that this God, who I tend to confine to who I think he is in my little place where I am, and I find out that he's so much bigger, and that he's working in so many ways in so many places. And he's the same God. He's not just the God of Luke in Southampton, but he's the God of Scotland even. Sorry. He's the God of all of these places. He's this huge God. And I learn more of who God is. And as I learn this, perhaps because I learn this, I learn more of who I am and how I am part of God's story. So maybe being part of a story still sounds like a crazy idea to you. Maybe lots of you can't relate to that. But I can assure you that you are part of the story. At the start of the week, Steve gave a talk about this place, Alpine. He told the story of how it ended up like this, of an American couple who used to camp up in the mountains. They prayed for a place. And Steve told that story. And the years have gone on, and it's an ongoing story. And with you all being here this week, you are now part of that story. You have become part of the story of Alpine. This guy called Stephen Shoemaker says, "Our lives must find their place in some greater story, or they will find their place in some lesser story." And I can assure you that our lives are part of the greatest story ever told. So as Moses' life can tell the story of Mount Sinai, and Abraham's can tell the story of Mount Moriah, our lives can tell the story of Mount Zion. Our lives can tell the story of God. I just pray and then give us some questions to think about. I assume we're having a discussion. I'll give you questions anyway. So, Heavenly Father, I thank you for Mount Zion. I thank you that it's because of you that we get to be here. I pray that this week has been a really good time of getting to know you and getting deeper into that relationship with you. And yeah, I pray that as we leave here, we will know that we're on Zion. We'll know that we're walking with you on Zion. I pray that you'd be showing us that we wouldn't be blinded to that. We wouldn't forget and just not know you at all, but we would know that we are walking on Zion with you. Amen. Cool. So I'll give you some questions. Maybe if you're not all going away tomorrow early in the morning, some of you are, but maybe if you're not, then you can do it throughout the day if you want. So these questions are possibly going to be frustrating because they're questions that I had when I was writing the talk. So as I was writing, I had these questions of how can this be? So hopefully it'll be good to discuss those instead of just having them as questions. Cool. So, one, do you know that you are currently walking on Mount Zion? How do you relate to that? Does that make sense? Do you know that you are currently walking on Mount Zion? How do you relate to that? Question 2. How can you reconcile receiving grace at Zion, but still being called to be holy? How can you reconcile receiving grace at Zion, but still being called to be holy? Okay. And what stories can you share to encourage each other in our identity as part of the story of God?